This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The drug crisis claims ever more lives. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
New stats indicate the opioid epidemic is driving up the overall premature death rate among Americans in the prime of their lives.
It's wedding season. Does the guy still seek permission from the girl's parents? We'll have a look at that tradition.
On this Father's Day weekend, how much is Dad worth this year? A new survey tries to put a dollar value on his contributions to the family.
And the new tech trends at the gym that really personalize your experience.
Well, one of the dilemmas of the gym is that generally gyms don't really know what you do once you show up. Sounds strange, but there really is no way to tell unless you sign up for a personal trainer or class. And they want to have more information about what you're doing so they can keep you coming back.
Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman on the tech invasion at higher-end gyms. She's here later in the hour. The opioid epidemic that has ravaged life expectancy among economically stressed white Americans is taking a rising toll among blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans, driving up the overall rate of premature death among Americans in the prime of their lives. Since the beginning of this decade, death rates have risen among people between the ages of 25 and 44 in virtually every racial and ethnic group, and almost all states. According to a new analysis by the Washington Post, more from staff writer Joel Achenbach. Joel, where do we start?
Okay, I'm going to throw some numbers at you, and I know that statistics make people's brains fog up, but this is an important number, is that in the age group 25 to 44, so, you know, young adults, you know, into early middle age, maybe, you know, but, you know, the prime of their lives. In that age group, since 2010, the death rate has gone up. It's gone up 8%. It had been going down because historically that's what happens. There's better medicine. There's, you know, the better medical treatment. People aren't supposed to die when they're 30 years old or 35 years old. But we have seen, starting around 2010, a reversal for that whole age cohort. So what does that mean? I mean, what is that telling us? Why are people dying at the age of 25, 30, 35, 40? The shortest answer, it's not a complete answer, is it's opioids and drugs, mixtures of fentanyl getting into the cocaine drugs that are going into inner cities. I mean, what we see is this phenomenon of the opioid crisis, which has killed lots of people in mostly sort of predominantly white communities, working class communities, the Rust Belt, West Virginia, Kentucky, you know, coal country, that this crisis is now coast to coast. It's almost everywhere. There's no boundary by any one demographic group. I mean, it's not like something that happens to people somewhere else. I mean, this happens in every community.
Yeah. Well, as one person said in your story, it is out of control.
Oh, totally. This has been building for 20 years, really since the introduction of OxyContin and some other opioid painkillers, which some people need those drugs. I mean, when we write these stories, people write to us and say, "Hey, you know, without these painkillers, I could not live my life. My life would be unbearable." Mm-hmm. So some people need them. The problem is, you go in for knee surgery, you go in for back surgery, or you know, you break your arm, whatever. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, your doctor, you know, gives you a prescription, and you know, you refill the prescription. Next thing you know, you need these things, and you start getting them, on the black market from friends. And some people wind up addicted to heroin, or they just stick with the pills, and they can be highly addictive. And I think the addictive nature of them was underestimated in for a long time. More recently, people understand that. But then comes heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil, these other drugs that are you know, washing across the country. So this is a crisis.
Jeez. We're speaking with Joel Achenbach, staff writer at The Washington Post. He mostly covers science, and he's written a piece entitled "The Drug Crisis is Now Pushing Up Death Rates for Almost All Groups of Americans." All right, so you say, too, the rash of deaths is a statistical echo of the 80s and early 90s when this combo of crack cocaine and HIV epidemics took a heavy toll. So is this, I don't know, another one, I hate to, for lack of a better word, another one of those phases?
Well, so if you, we're talking specifically about a relatively young group, 25 to 44. You know, I want to say, like, you know, childbearing age, although that's not exactly the right term. You know, but you know, sort of, you know, young, relatively young adults. That back in the 80s, because of HIV and because of the spread of crack cocaine and all the overdoses associated with that, you did see an uptick in the death rates then. That's unusual, because typically the death rates for all groups have gone down. So life expectancy goes up, death rates go down. That's the norm. That's what you want. That's the result of technology and better medicine and you know, new ways to intervene with diseases, you know, and particularly cancer. You know, cancer is not as lethal as it was 40 years ago. So these things help push down the death rates, extend life. But these periods come along where some kind of drug gets introduced into the population, or in the case of HIV, it's an emerging disease, an emerging pathogen, and that can put the numbers in reverse. And so what we're seeing now is since 2010, the death rates have gone up for whites, blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans. The only group that didn't have a statistically significant rise was Asian Americans. And this is an important point, because so much of the media coverage has focused on whites and the opioid epidemic among whites. It's important for people to understand that there's no sharp boundary there. I mean, this is happening across the country, big cities, small towns, you know, you name it, California, New York, Florida. It's not just, you know, West Virginia and Kentucky.
Thanks, Joel. Joel Achenbach, staff writer at The Washington Post. What dad doesn't love to grill, especially when it's a great steak? Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. And now this Father's Day, for only $49.99, you can get a limited-time Father's Day package when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter deal in the search bar. Omaha Steaks even offers online support with recipes and wine pairings. Here's the offer: 80% off Omaha Steaks Father's Day package, which includes 2 tender mild filet mignons, 2 beefy top sirloins, 4 crispy chicken fried steaks, 4 juicy boneless pork chops, 4 all-beef Omaha Steak burgers, 4 gourmet jumbo franks, 12 ounces of all-beef meatballs, 1 pound of steakhouse fries, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, 1 Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get 4 additional burgers free. Only $49.99 at omahasteaks.com. Type deal in the search bar and add Father's Day package to your cart. This offer ends soon. Go to omahasteaks.com, type deal in the search bar, grab your dad, and fire up the grill. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. The Great Cycle Challenge USA is a month-long national cycling fundraiser taking place right now, benefiting the Children's Cancer Research Fund. For more on the subject of children's cancer, we're joined by Dr. Logan Spector, professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota, where he researches children's cancer. Dr. Spector, give us some stats first.
Yeah, well, there's about 12,000 new cases diagnosed each year. That'd be in kids under 15. Actually, there's about 2,000 or 3,000 of them who die each year. So although we've made great strides in treating childhood cancer, it's still the number one cause of death due to disease in kids.
Put that number in perspective, that 12,000 a year. Is it higher, lower, the same as it's been over course of years or decades?
As best we can tell, it's actually been rising about 1% or 2% per year since the 70s.
Wow. Any reason why? Do we know why?
Some of it's better diagnosis. Some of it is probably demographic risk factors. We know that risk rises with parental age, and parents have been getting older. So that's part of it, but mostly we don't know.
How about the status of research these days? I mean, I can't wait to the day we announce a cure, right? That we got some sort of medicine or pill or injection that cures it?
Well, we've done pretty well, like I said, but we've been repurposing drugs for adults. Because the market in kids is so small, there hasn't been a lot of research looking at drugs that were specifically for kids. So we are curing about 75% of the kids with cancer, but I should add that they have lifelong chronic health problems due to the treatment. So anything we could find that kills the cancer without giving them this after effects would be a huge boon.
Anything on your radar right now that appears to be most promising or seems to be working for the kids?
Well, there are some things we call targeted therapies. Those just kill the cancer cells without affecting normal healthy cells. We've had some progress with that. And then also, you may have heard of immunotherapy. That's where scientists and physicians are using the body's own immune cells to attack the tumors, which is incredibly powerful. But I'd say we're really in the prehistoric stages of that research.
Okay. Which means what? We're decades away from something like that?
Predictions are hard, especially about the future, but we've had some early successes. I think we'll see it rolled out in the mass scale in the next 10 years.
And you mentioned before that with some of these treatments, there are lifelong health effects that the kids could suffer, like what?
Well, starting with, it can stunt their growth, so they end up obese. There is some treatments that give congestive heart failure in the 30s and 40s, a decade of life, which is very early. They have a higher risk of second cancers, major joint replacements, and just early mortality.
Wow.
So, you know, I can't understate. These treatments work, but they are toxic.
We're speaking with Dr. Logan Spector, professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota, does a lot with children's cancer research. And we're tying this all together as part of the Great Cycle Challenge USA, which is taking place in the month of June.
Yeah, to date, there's not a lot of evidence that catching it early actually improves outcomes, but it's a very difficult thing to study with cancers where the rate is about 150 cases per million. A lot easier to figure that out when you have common cancers. So we're always trying to detect them earlier, and we certainly hope that catching a tumor when it's the size of a grape instead of a grapefruit would help.
Well, what are the most common types of cancers for children?
The single most common type of cancer in kids is leukemia, followed by brain cancer and lymphoma.
Do you have a tie-in yourself to the Great Cycle Challenge, by the way?
Yes, I'm riding in it this June. I'm riding for Team Osteo. That's raising money for osteosarcoma research. Osteosarcoma is a bone cancer that occurs in about 400 kids and teens each year in the U.S.
If there was just a pool of unendless money tied to research, would that speed things along? Is money for research the big issue? Or is it actually kind of working through the science of discovery and things like that?
You know, it's really both. Certainly, you won't find a scientist anywhere who would turn down unlimited money.
Yeah.
But you also need good minds working on the problem. Childhood cancer is... attracts a lot of bright minds because, of course, these are kids with cancer.
Sure.
But a lot of people think it's a rare disease and difficult to make a career out of. The science, I think, is because, like I just mentioned, we can sequence genomes now. The pace of science is picking up immensely. So I think with a good amount of money, some of it is going to come from philanthropy like the Great Cycle Challenge. We actually will make way more progress in the next decade than we have in the last 30.
Thanks, Logan. Dr. Logan Spector from the University of Minnesota. For more, by the way, visit greatcyclechallenge.com. It's 22 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. At least there's still some good old-fashioned respect going on when it comes to wedding traditions. Turns out the groom is still seeking permission to marry. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Should you get the parents' blessing before popping the question? Many would-be grooms are still doing this today with a few twists. Here with a story, Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. So, Sue, this old-fashioned idea hasn't gone out of style yet?
It hasn't. I was surprised to learn that more than 3 out of 4 suitors still ask the father's or the parents' blessing or permission to marry their girlfriends or even fiancés in some cases. It has somewhat different meaning than it used to, but it's very, very common.
Why bother asking if often the couples are already living together and have been together for a long time?
This is what parents sometimes say, like, why are you even asking me? But I think couples today see this both as a sign of respect for the family, that this new in-law wants to be accepted and really sees the family connections as very important. And also, I think they want family support. They're entering marriage at a time when divorce is rampant, and they hope the families will help them hold it together in some cases.
So how do the grooms-to-be go about asking? Do they ask the father? Is it a very formal kind of thing, or is it a little looser today?
It's a little looser today. It varies. Some suitors still ask the parents out to dinner and make a formal request, albeit awkwardly. But others try to slip it into casual conversations. They ask mom as well as dads. They're really putting their own stamp on it. And sometimes this can create some awkwardness if the casual conversation doesn't go as planned.
Do the brides-to-be know this is going to happen ahead of time?
Interestingly, most of the brides and couples I interviewed did not know. And I think this was kind of seen as a gift by the suitor to the bride, a sign of respect. Every bride I interviewed said that she was grateful and appreciated the fact that the groom had asked permission. And one even said that she would have been nervous if he hadn't. She was only 24 years old at the time they were planning to marry, and she really appreciated the fact that her parents approved.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. Sue, are some people kind of asking just for general support rather than, hey, can I marry your daughter?
Yes, I think they already know in most cases that the family has accepted them. It's not usually a surprise to the family that a wedding is planned, but they really are hoping for support. In some cases, they go on and engage the parents in planning some of the wedding rituals that mark so many ceremonies today. It's just a sign that we want to draw closer as a family.
Did you talk to any people where the bride and the groom go to talk to both sets of parents or anything more untraditional?
This does happen. Sometimes both partners go to talk with parents about it. I didn't happen to find any of those in my reporting. Another untraditional twist is that more lesbian and gay couples are doing this as well. They, too, want family's approval and support.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenko coming up this half hour. How to take an effective leave of absence. We'll have some advice for CEOs. Also, your gym's tech wants to know you better. Are you prepared for this? And what's a dad worth this year? Well, Father's Day story. We'll have that one in about 20 minutes. Former Olympic gold medalist and now TV host Summer Sanders has swum miles and miles as part of her training and even post-Olympic career, but those battles pale in comparison to surviving melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. You remember her for 2 golds, a silver, and a bronze in Barcelona at the 92 Games when she was still a student at Stanford. One of her golds was for the 200-meter butterfly. She joins us now. And Summer, this isn't supposed to happen to our Olympic idols.
I know. We're real people, right? I should have known it. I'm a California girl. I spent every waking hour outside in my backyard pool.
Yeah.
I grew up in the 70s where, if you consider SPF 4 sunscreen, then that's what I use. But I have dark skin, dark hair, dark eyes. It doesn't run in my family. I never set foot in a tanning bed. and I haven't had many sunburns. So there you go. You have my makeup.
Wow.
But I got melanoma in my 40s. It was a small dot on my calf. It was really dark. My husband kept saying to me, you should get that checked out. For a year and a half, he said that to me. And I know that's going to resonate with your listeners. And it took me that long to get a dermatology appointment. I was like, all right, well, I should probably get this checked out. Like, my doctor wasn't very worried. He took it off. And then 7 days later, I got that call that scared me to death, which said, I need to see you tomorrow. You have stage one malignant melanoma.
So you've had melanoma and removed it. Does that mean, though, that you're still susceptible for getting it? Are you always on the lookout?
I'm always on the lookout, mostly because I'm just hyper crazy about it. It's almost become a pastime for me. I mean, I look for it on my friends. I will even let strangers know if think one of their moles looks funky. But yes, I'm always susceptible. And my understanding is that the more I get it, the more often I could get it. So the fact that I've had three melanoma, that means that I am there's a really good chance that I'm going to get more in my life.
Right.
But I am aware, and I look all over my body, and I get them early.
How do you treat your kids now, by the way, given what you went through?
I know, right? Yeah, well, my kids know. I remind them all the time, you are so lucky that your mom had melanoma.
Jeez, yeah.
Because you're never getting a sunburn.
Right.
Yeah, they know sunscreen. They're worried about it, too, just in that they don't want to get sunburned. So I've programmed them to the point where they know to put sunscreen on, and they have this tiny little cute panic if they don't have sunscreen and they're out for a field trip, let's say.
We're speaking with Summer Sanders, Olympic champion, TV host. We're talking about protecting from skin cancer. Take me back to Barcelona 92, in the swimming events.
Yeah.
Did you know at that time, you were probably still a student, right, at Stanford. Did you know that you were going to pursue TV and acting and that stuff, or did that fall in your lap given your success in Barcelona?
No, for as long as I wanted to swim in the Olympic Games, which it became a dream when I was probably about 10, I knew I wanted to be on television.
Okay.
A lot of people assume that. They just think, well, if you were in sports, then you probably just got a job in sports. And yes, sports helped me, excuse me, achieve that goal. But it was always a goal of mine. And I feel so blessed that I got to do both these things that I was extremely passionate about, because I know passion is hard to find.
Career. Summer Sanders, former Olympic gold medalist and now TV host. It is 22 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. Uber CEO Travis Kalanick will be taking a leave of absence as the company overcomes a troublesome year. He made the announcement to staff this past week, just as the company he founded announced partial results of a nearly four-month investigation into its workplace culture. But what makes for an effective leave of absence? We're joined now by Andrew Whitman, CEO of the Mental Toughness Training Center. He advises executives on managing pressure and mental stamina. Andrew, how do you be effective?
The first thing is to actually be absent. So what you got to do is stay off all social media. That's the first thing. No mainstream media, and be in seclusion away from the TMZers, I call it, right? No public appearances, no fundraisers, no banquets, balls, no plays, festivals, or concerts.
And most of all, I guess, don't even show up at the office.
Well, no, of course not there, especially not there. Like, don't even be seen in the parking lot across the street, staking out, you know, your favorite coffee joint that you always, you know, have lunch at and hold court at. No, none of that. You have to be completely off the radar.
All right. Or else what? You're sending mixed signals then?
Yeah, you're not really taking a leave of absence, you know, at all. And so this whole thing, in order for it to be authentic and for us to believe you, and that's why we're doing it, right? Let's be honest. The reason that you're taking the leave of absence is because the heat is too high in the public arena. So for us to believe you, you've got to really just disappear and just be completely off the radar, and not even be like, you know, the man behind the curtain in Oz. We just have to totally not see you at all.
By doing that, do you give the impression that there may be something fishy going on that you're afraid to address?
No, I think it's, you're hitting it head on. So if you're going to take a leave of absence, just take a leave of absence. I'm not, and turn it over, turn the keys over, you know, to the board and whoever is coming in while I'm gone. Otherwise, it does look fishy if it looks like you're meddling and you never really did take the leave of absence. I'm always reminded of like the 80s and the televangelists that would, you know, get caught in the great sin, and then they would like take a leave of absence for 3 months, and then they're back in the pulpit. I mean, really, did anybody believe that?
Right. You say, too, take an honest assessment of your internal identity. Explain that.
Yeah, so your identity is not what you do. So being CEO of you, that's an external. I mean, CEO of a company, you're an external. If you're the founder of, you know, a tech company, that's an external. Being rich, that's an external. So who are you? Who do you want to be? What's the internal strength you want to highlight? You know, do you want to be seen as a person of integrity? I am a person of integrity who always keeps his word, you know, something that you aspire to. And when you get that internal identity down, then we can begin to believe you. Because what happens is once you figure out who it is that you want to be, what you aspire to be internally for the rest of your life, all of your behavior becomes a byproduct of who you are. We're talking about the difference between character and reputation.
We're speaking with Andrew Whitman. He's the CEO of Mental Toughness Training Center in South Carolina. He's a former Marine and special agent. Teaches Fortune 500 executives how to deal with pressure. Number three on your list, make the course corrections for when you're taking a leave of absence as CEO.
Yeah, and the biggest thing, once you do make the course correction, here's the hard part, Gordon. The hard part is that it's to be authentic and credible, I need a track record of fidelity of your new found, you know, I turned over the new leaf. This is me 2.0. Mm-hmm. Listen, it took you years for us to see the train wreck that you are. It's not going to be fixed in weeks or months. It's also going to take a track record of years for us to believe it. Right. So when I first came on as a federal agent, I first showed up at work. I had a supervisor tell me, hey, Andrew, if you're late to work and you call in sick a lot and that's your reputation, if you want to change that, it would take you 3 years to fix it. The reverse is also true. We know it could take you a lifetime to build a credible reputation and you could wreck it in an instant. And there's tons of folks that we see in the public today that the trail is just littered with them, that they have had great careers, but then that one misstep. So this is the reverse. It's going to take a lot of time for us to believe you. It's not going to be over in 3 months.
Thanks, Andrew. Andrew Whitman, CEO of the Mental Toughness Training Center. It's 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for joining us. Developing trend at the gym. From the Apple Watch to eagle-eyed sensors, digital technology is going ever further to embed itself into your health club. These advances promise exercisers everything from smoother workout starts to better data in order to increase gym attendance. More from Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. Rachel, what's up at the gym?
Well, one of the dilemmas of the gym is that generally gyms don't really know what you do once you show up. Sounds strange, but there really is no way to tell unless you sign up for a personal trainer or a class. And they want to have more information about what you're doing so they can keep you coming back, meet your needs. So one of the things that's happening, probably the biggest news, is that the Apple Watch coming this fall is going to have a software upgrade that will let people sync their Apple Watch to a whole slew of cardio equipment. So, you know, bikes, treadmills, things like that, most major brands. And, you know, that will let people walk away with all their workout data, whereas now there's sort of a patchwork system using smartphone apps that don't always line up with the right brands and so on. So it's kind of a messy system, and certainly most people don't like to stand there at the treadmill, you know, punching in their weight and age and things like that. So this is really a much more smooth way to go if you happen to own an Apple Watch.
All right, so what else is there?
Well, Equinox is rolling out a couple of interesting things. That's the New York-based luxury health club, although they have locations elsewhere around the country and the world. They're testing a chatbot for new members, and what this will do is essentially simulate text message conversations on someone's smartphone. They've tested it with new members, and the idea is to basically have a virtual, you know, simulated human conversation via text with this chatbot, and you know, the bot will get you to set fitness goals and you know, how many times you want to come to the gym, other reasons why you're going there, and so on. And the bot will actually prompt you if you're not showing up and ask you how it can help and things like that. And they've tested this for about a month at every location with new members. members, and they say new members who opt into the chatbot are showing up 40% more than those who opt out, which is sort of interesting. It's a short test, but it's very intriguing.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. She writes about exercise, and her piece is called Your Gym's Tech Wants to Know You Better. Any of this stuff cost extra?
Generally, no, although certainly, like with the Apple Watch, you have to own one.
Yeah.
And I should emphasize that, you know, these things are happening at higher-end clubs. You know, this technology is expensive. Equinox developed this itself, their own chatbot. There's actually a Bay Area-based company called Active Wellness that's even pioneering a facial recognition system that will allow members to simply breeze into the club without a membership card or without talking to anybody, and someday might even, you know, automatically adjust things like a Stairmaster when you approach it, because it'll simply recognize who you are. So some of this is fairly high-tech stuff.
Who's saying that gyms might be collecting too much information about us?
I did talk to one member who was a little creeped out about it. You know, in fact, she said it seemed sort of opposite to some of the other things that gyms preach, like, you know, relaxation and kind of getting away from it all and so on, getting in touch with yourself.
Thanks, Rachel. That's Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman, who's based in New York. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Can you really put a price on what dad is worth on this Father's Day weekend? Does he do anything worthwhile other than commandeer the grill and scorch the burgers and hot dogs? A survey by Insure.com attempts to put a value on his work around the house and with the family by using U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics to measure the economic value of his services. CBS News broke it down. The good news, Pop's value grew 6% this year after a decline last year that put him almost at the poverty line. It rose to $26,000 this year as dad's manned up to duties like scout leader, lawnmower, and, not incidentally, bug squasher. The bad news for males everywhere in the U.S., the survey says, moms do a lot more, so are worth a lot more. At least that's what the survey, conducted by a woman, shows here. In contrast to dad, mom's value rose to a new high of $67,000 this year. It showed that this trend has been on the rise since 2014. Not to brag, by the way, but I am the CEO of the laundry folding division of my house, so surely my worth is higher than that average. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.